With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everybody. You're listening to the Third Coast Podcast. I'm Katie Mingle. If you're a fan of the podcast or of any of the work that Third Coast does, I hope you'll consider supporting us with a donation. We're in the middle of our end-of-the-year fundraising campaign, and donations from listeners like you truly do help us out. Go to our website, thirdcoastfestival.org, to give, and while you're there, feel free to browse our library of nearly 1,000 audio docs and pick up some cool holiday gifts in our merch shop. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast.
From the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago, I'm Gwen Maxey, and this is ReSound. ReSound is a remix of music, documentaries, found sound, sound bites, and sonic secrets we reveal only to you.
I was invaded by music from my very, very infancy.
We listened to find the very best audio from all over the world and then offer it up to you on ReSound.
The only other thing that really like obsesses me as much as music is the insanity of injustice.
There's so much more to music than notes on a page. Imbued in the essence of any song or symphony are generations of influence and life experience.
There's no political rally that ever happened in South Africa without singing being the main feature.
Jazz, especially, was born during turbulent times, and behind the music are often sad and beautiful stories of historical significance and personal struggle.
100 years later, the Negro still is not free.
Later in this hour, the story of Ann Searcy, a 76-year-old jazz singer who grew up as one of the only people of color in Old Orchard Beach, Maine, where music legend Duke Ellington became her hero. But first, the musical and political journey of South African jazz artist and activist Hugh Masekela. Born in Witbank, South Africa, his career paralleled and was inextricably linked to the fight for civil rights in both the United States and South Africa. Now we learn about the man behind the trumpet. And I assure you, if you aren't a fan now, you will be by the time Of Home and Heart is over.
I grew up in a country that is pregnant with music of all types, and of course the melting pot of Southern and Central Africa. I was marinated in jazz and I was seasoned in music from home. I'm a great student of African music. But I have a very wide training in that I played in the dance bands, in the dance halls in South Africa, in the townships where you used to have to duck bullets and knives. Every time you looked at South African news, people were being shot at, but they were always singing. I remember Dizzy Gillespie saying to me one day, I'd like to be in this revolution because there's so much music and everybody seems so happy, there's a lot of dancing. I lived in exile for 30 years. I left South Africa when I was 21. I came back when I was 51.
Oh,
It's impossible to divorce Hugh Masekela and his music from the political struggles of South Africa. From early childhood, his musical development was intricately woven with the life and politics of the country. He was born in 1939 under a British colonial administration, just 9 years before the introduction of apartheid. He grew up in Witbank, a one-street, right-wing Afrikaner town, surrounded by coal mines and coal trains with endless carriages pulled by steam engines churning smoke into the air. Men from all over southern and central Africa came to work in the mines. At night, they'd drink themselves into a stupor at his grandmother's shebeen to blot out the memory of the blackness of the mines and the families and land they'd left behind. Hugh's childhood was shaped by their stories and songs.
Song is the literature of South Africa. It's the literature of most of Southern and Central Africa and West Africa. Everything is expressed a lot through song. If there's weddings, there's songs for that. There's no political rally that ever happened in South Africa without singing being the main feature. In the churches, before television, when we were kids, we had hundreds and hundreds of songs. Weekends were always carnivals because of the great migrant labor population from Central and Southern Africa and the South African hinterland. On weekends, they used to find open spaces and show their stuff in their costumes and pageantry and the dances and stuff like that. And we grew up with that.
The first townships were like real hovels, you know, mostly mud houses with corrugated iron roofs and like make-do fences and all that thing. My grandmother was one of those few people who like were enterprising and had like a what you call a shebeen, which was an illegal drinking house, because liquor was not legalized for Africans in South Africa until 1961. All the miners used to come and drink at different times. I mean, the house was built so that like the township elite would drink in the living in the dining room, and my grandmother's friends, they'd be sitting with her while she was cooking, ironing her clothes and serving other people in the kitchen. They used to drink in the kitchen. There was a big kitchen table and iron coal stove, and then there was a big yard with small little stoops where like most of the laborers, people from the mines, used to drink, and they'd drink sorghum beer, which is the cheapest kind of beer that was brewed. And one of the great things also about Witbank was that all these people brought their different musics and their different stories about where they came from. And as a little kid, I mean, I hung out with all of them in the backyard, in the kitchen, and you know, knew all about their countries.
Everybody had a gramophone. We were the most voracious consumers of any kind of music. The most popular music when I was a kid was cowboys. Roy Rogers, Tex Ritter, Jim Reeves, Gene Autry. And we knew all their songs from Ghost Riders, In the Sky, you know. We used to like imitate when we were kids Smiley Burnett because he was the greatest yodeler. Are you ready? We loved all that stuff. E-B-I-O, E-B-I-O. I was invaded by music from my very, very infancy, and it's the only thing I've ever heard in my head. The only other thing that really like obsesses me as much as music is the insanity of injustice. was the only home that didn't have a gramophone. My grandmother, she didn't want it. Joanna didn't listen to any music except she was in the Lutheran church. She was a prayer woman in the Lutheran church, and she sang those songs. But she also was in Ndebele, the Ndebele Royal. So, like, she also sang, like, the traditional songs. When Johanna died, she was 104, and we sang by her bedside the songs that she used to sing us. We used to sing with her when we were little kids. Walila umtwana elilela umamake wamtata wambegesi fubeni sake watitula sanalwam watitula sanalwam. Those are songs that were sang to us when we were small, you know. I lived for the gramophone. My grandmother's sister lived two doors away from us. And my uncle Putu had a gramophone, and he had a most beautiful voice. In fact, he was my first influence. I still tried to sing like him and used his technique. He became an Anglican priest, and he used to sing all those Ora pro nobis, you know, and stuff like that. We used to sing along together when I was 2, 3. Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga choo-choo? You know, and I got a girl in Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo. And I didn't know what I was singing about. I had an idea because my parents had been school teachers, so they taught us how to read when we were very small. When I was 5, 6, I was already reading the newspapers for my grandmother and her friends, you know, as on Saturday they'd sit around sniffing their snuff and they'd say, so what are the white people saying? Is Hitler coming? And we'd imitate Nat King Cole. Mona, and some kids just used to do him spot on, you know. Mona Lisa. And then we'd all join in harmony. Mona Lisa. And at night, you know, singing us, and then somebody, shut up, we're trying to sleep.
Was it Louis Armstrong that drew you to the trumpet, or was it Clifford Brown?
No, it was a movie called Young Man with a Horn.
Hello, sir. Which one's the cheapest?
Well, let me see. I think the trumpet. I can let you have this one for about $9. Play a trumpet?
No, but I can learn. I started to learn piano. If I had one of those, I could carry it around with me and play it any time I wanted.
You got the money?
No, but I could get a job.
Well, now, I think maybe you are a musician.
Yes, sir.
It was a story of Big Spider Big, and I don't know if you saw it, but Kirk Douglas played the part.
Someday when I'm really good, I'm going to do things with this trumpet nobody's ever thought of doing. I'm going to hit a note that nobody ever heard before.
And Harry James played the soundtrack, and Harry James had the most unbelievable, beautiful tone. I mean, when he played ballads, whether it was I'm in the Mood for Love or My Dream is Yours or Stardust, you know. I'd been a piano player already for like 8 years, but when I heard the soundtrack on that, I had to play the trumpet.
News from Government House Pretoria, where South Africa's newly elected Prime Minister, Dr. Malan, was sworn in at the beginning of a new chapter in South Africa's history.
The colour question is rapidly increasing in seriousness and urgency. I consider apartheid, that's the separation policy, to be South Africa's last chance to remain a white man's country.
In 1948, the Conservative National Party won parliamentary elections and gained control of the South African government. Apartheid, a word that means separateness in Afrikaans, became national policy. Within 2 years, legislation was enacted which would dispossess many black South Africans of their land and segregate communities into racial groups. Hugh moved to the city to live with his parents and was sent to St Peter's, an Anglican boarding school run by Father Trevor Huddleston, a British chaplain and vocal campaigner against the new apartheid laws.
Father Huddleston, who was like, you know, he really like got the anti-apartheid movement going. He started me out because he was a friend of my parents. My mother was a social worker and my father was chief health inspector in Alexander Township, which was the hub of the resistance in South Africa. And Mandela, all of them, wherever they came from in the hinterlands, they started their lives in Alexander Township. So Huddleston, who was also an ANC person, knew my parents, and he was very worried about me because I was a very restless soul. In boarding school, he was our chaplain. I was in bed with the flu. He said, "What do you really want to do, creature?" He called everybody creature. I said, "Because the monks, the nuns, the monitors, the prefects, the teachers, everybody is complaining about you." And I said, "If I can get a trumpet, Father, I think I won't bother anybody anymore." So he got me not only a trumpet, but a trumpet teacher. Uncle Sauda was the head of the Johannesburg Municipal Native Brass Band. And 3 months later, I was playing songs, so the kids, some of them just went to Huddleston and said, "Father, can I have a trombone? Can I have a trumpet?" And he'd go out and hustle them.
Among the very few places in colonial South Africa where black South Africans had access to good music teaching were the Anglican-run schools. This was one of the things that apartheid ended. One of the things it did was to change the curriculum and close those schools. So Masekela and his playing colleagues, including Jonas Gwangwa and many others, actually had a formal music training. They heard church music. They heard the music of peddy drummers on the streets. They heard miners' music in the shebeens. They went to the Odin Cinema and heard Lena Horne singing Salt Lake City Blues. And of course, in Hugh's case, he also talks with great affection about the traditional music, rural music, which his grandmother also sang. So out of all these things, it was a very syncretic mix. It wasn't that one was more influential than another. But they all came together, and of course, with a musical brain, you also see commonalities between them. Like you see the syncopation in jazz music as bearing a family relationship to the syncopation and hocketing in African traditional music. Those kinds of things happen.
Gwen Ansell, music journalist, academic, and author of Soweto Blues, a history of jazz, popular music, and politics in South Africa.
When Huddleston was deported from South Africa, when he was asked to leave, the community of the Resurrection, his order, had a lot of missions also in the United States. And he went through there. One of the monks was an outstanding clarinet player, and he had become a friend of Louis Armstrong's. I mean, he introduced Huddleston to Louis Armstrong, and Huddleston told Louis Armstrong about the band of young Africans. And Louis Armstrong sent us one of his trumpets, and we became famous without even having tried. At the time that the trumpet came, Louis Armstrong was on tour all over Africa, but he wasn't allowed to come to South Africa. But his trumpet was just bigger than if he had come on tour.
By 1960, Hugh Masekela was well known in South Africa. Along with the beautiful young singer Miriam Makeba, he'd played trumpet in the orchestra of the successful musical King Kong, which toured throughout South Africa and was invited to London. He was getting regular work, performing to packed houses 7 nights a week with his band, the Jazz Epistles. Band members included Jonas Gwangwa and Abdullah Ibrahim, who, like Masekela, went on to have international careers. The Jazz Epistles played a mixture of bebop favourites by Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker and Duke Ellington, as well as composing their own songs.
The music of the Jazz Epistles was actually some of the most exciting that anybody had heard at that time. They made one album just before, this was now the 1960s, and the clearances of areas like Sophiatown were now proceeding apace. So this was, in fact, one of the last chances for that kind of music to flourish within South Africa.
Here is a special announcement. The Governor General has proclaimed a state of emergency in about 80 of the 300 magisterial districts of the country.
Several hundred natives gathered peaceably to protest the pass laws. Police mounted on tanks opened fire. 69 natives were killed, 176 wounded. Most of the victims were shot in the back. Some of the dead were children, women, and elderly men.
During the 50s, the apartheid government had introduced a raft of legislation which made it more and more difficult for black South Africans to have any kind of career. Resistance in the country was growing. After the Sharpeville massacre, the government declared a state of emergency and gatherings of more than 10 people were banned.
I'd been trying to leave South Africa since 1955. The man who had got me my first trumpet in high school, Trevor Huddleston, went to England, and we kept in touch, and I just kept saying to him, I know that I'll never get the kind of education and access to an international attention I could get if I left the country. You know, I had to get out of there, plus it was getting worse. And I knew also that if I didn't get out of the country, I would be very, very involved in like a violent political reaction. So my love for music was very strong at the time, and I was becoming an exponent of bebop. And like, I really just wanted to go to New York to be a sideman, like the Jazz Messengers or the, you know, Horace Silver group, or just, you know, it's one of the quintets.
Apartheid had been in place for 12 years. After Sharpeville in 1960, you had, in fact, curfews and other rules which prevented large gatherings. It became almost impossible for musicians to work together before big audiences. You had the turning of the South African Broadcasting Corporation into Radio Bantu with strictly segregated playing slots, and a hybrid music like jazz simply would not find a place on the radio. And for that reason, because record companies depended on airplay for their sales, the record companies were also beginning to segregate and narrowly define the genres in which their artists performed. So everything together by the early 60s was coming together to make it a very inhospitable place for creative musicians who wanted to work with a degree of freedom.
A ping pong ball down a mountain stream, like paper riding in the breeze, like strolling in the dark through streets you know.
It was very difficult for musicians to leave. They were either refused passports completely. If you had any kind of politics, even the most mildly outspoken, you'd definitely be refused a visa. Or alternatively, you were given a one-way visa. In other words, your passport was endorsed and you couldn't come back. So it was extremely difficult for people to get out. And many people, including Masekela and Gwangwa, left the country in the touring cast of the musical show King Kong and then did not return.
Come on, Lucky. Let's go.
Back of the moon, boys, back of the moon, boys. Don't you really know the game, back of the moon. The end of the day, boys, up with your papers. Stand it out of back of the moon.
Hugh left South Africa in 1960 with a scholarship to London's Guildhall School of Music. But whilst in London, he dreamed of New York and joining jazz men like Clifford Brown and Miles Davis.
Hurry, 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 take the A train to find the quickest way to get to Harlem.
Longtime friend and lover Miriam Makeba was already in the United States, touring with Harry Belafonte, and she arranged for Hugh to join them. In 1964, they married. It was a stormy relationship that lasted only a few years, but they remained lifelong friends, musical collaborators, and occasional lovers.
Actually, Miriam invented me. She brought me to the States. She was my girlfriend when we were in South Africa. It was quite a scandal because she was 7 years older than me. And when I met Miriam, I was 16. She was 23. And it wasn't a scandal as much as that older guys really like hated me for it. But I was quite a tough kid, so they couldn't really mess with me. And I had bad friends, too. So they kept off. And we dreamt about making it overseas with Miriam. And she went a year before me, and she wrote to me, and she introduced me to Dizzy, to Louis, through letters, you know, to J.J. Johnson, to Miles.
And also to Harry Belafonte, who was a big benefactor
of
hers,
she was on tour with Belafonte at the time. In fact, when I arrived in the States for 3 months, I didn't get to see them because they were on tour. But I was looking for, because I did my first album in 1961, and I was really looking to play like with Art Blakey, the Jazz Messengers, because Clifford Brown came out of there, and Lee Morgan and Donald Byrd and Freddie Hubbard, you know, everybody came out of the Jazz Messengers, Blue Mitchell and Buhana. Art Blakey just said, "No, man, you come from Africa, you got to do your own thing, you know." And I tried Horace Silver. "No, man, you got to play your own thing, you know." And everybody wouldn't give me a job. So, like, I said, "You know, you're going to just be a statistic. So, but if you do something like Miriam from South Africa, from your home, man, you know, then we're going to learn something and you'll be different from all of us." At that time, I didn't know where to start, you know, and I started to say, "Miriam, remember like the songs that in the dance bands," and we tried to, you know, we remembered those. But then Miriam had like a repertoire of hundreds of songs from her mother, who was a traditional healer, and who just had a 7-octave voice. She could sing like a man, she could sing like a little girl. And that's how I learned the songs. So my first album, the Americanization of Ooga Booga, that really resonated with audiences. I think I have about 3 or 4 songs that I learned from Miriam and her daughter.
At this time, we'd like to do for you a song that comes from Swaziland. It's a song that I learned from my wife, who learned it from her mother. It's a healing song. And the words say, "When I was able and healthy, I had many friends, but now that I am bedridden, I see many smiles on many faces." Bajabula bonke uma ngilele phansi. Yelele babe bajabula bonke uma ngilele phansi baboya siya u kulima. Yelele babe bajabula bonke uma ngilele phansi baboya siya u. Yeah.
was forced to sing. You know, in bebop, you wore dark glasses and like Ivy League suits with pencil ties, and you didn't sing. You were cool. So when people like Belafonte and Miriam and Miles Davis, you know, and Dizzy said, why don't you do like Miriam and like bring in stuff from your home? So I started to Larry Willis, who was my first piano player, got two other musicians when we were at Manhattan School of Music. And I was teaching them the songs, and I'd sing them the melodies, and they kept saying, man, you gotta sing, man. And finally they conspired with Miriam, and she said, if you don't sing, I'm gonna leave you, and there was not gonna be any band song. I was forced to sing, and I remember the first night I had to sing at the Village Gate was like one of the most painful moments of my life. I sort of sang with my eyes closed because I couldn't watch the people. I just felt that I just didn't have any credibility what I was doing. And when I finished the song, people just screamed. For I've been singing since then. And Louis Armstrong had told me, you gotta sing, because if I can sing, anybody can sing.
We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Harry Belafonte was the largest fundraiser for the civil rights movement. I mean, he like got all the artists together. I don't know how many civil rights rallies and fundraisers I did with him and Miriam. Diane Carroll, Sidney Poitier, Marlon Brando, all those people. His favorite people were actually like SNCC, you know, the Student Nonviolent Coordination, and Martin Luther King, you know, and SNCC was like Julian Bond and John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael and all those people. But again, the funny thing is that even though I was in the States or even in England, you know, like racial prejudice against people of African origin was always like reeking, you know, and in the States it was more dangerous because in South Africa it was legislative. So the cops carried out all the racism, really. And to a certain extent, protected you against lynchings and all that. Whereas in the States, it was more volatile and more dangerous, and you were more vulnerable because anybody could kidnap you and go and string you up. When we were students, we had some students who were killed mysteriously in Pennsylvania. They went to Lincoln University, and they were going out with white girls, and both of them were run over by cars. So I didn't leave New York City for a year and a half, because Philadelphia, New Jersey, they were really like were dangerous places to go to. The one thing that still worries me today in the world is that people of African origin or African hue, African complexion, anywhere in the world you go, most of the people of African origin still live in squalor and abject poverty. And I think it's a crying shame to humanity at this point. I mean, there are many other poor ethnic groups, but collectively, Africans all over the world live in squalor. So the world hasn't changed too much.
I ask you, and all the leaders of the world, would you keep silent and do nothing if you were in our place? Would you not resist if you were allowed no rights in your own country? because the color of your skin is different to that of the rulers. I appeal to you to do everything you can to stop the coming tragedy. I appeal to you to save the lives of our leaders, to empty the prisons of all those who should never have been there.
At the same time that both Hugh and Miriam were heavily involved in the civil rights movement in the United States, they continued to speak out about conditions in South Africa. It made them unpopular with authorities in the US and brought them unwanted attention from the CIA and the FBI.
Remember the climate of the 60s? It may have been the era of flower power, but it was also a very intense period within the Cold War. And South Africans who were supporters of the nationalist movement at home, like Miriam Makeba, who spoke out immensely bravely at the UN and in many other forums, and people like Hugh. I mean, Hugh made some music which perhaps is not so well known in this country. He made albums with track titles like Grenades and Guns, which were about what was going on here. And to the CIA, Hugh has said, we knew the CIA was watching us all the time. This was communist subversion. Remember that America in that period was an ally of apartheid South Africa. It saw apartheid South Africa as a bastion against Russia in the Cold War.
I remember, a time of just being hounded in the States. The South African government worked very closely to make sure that I was discredited, because I could go on to the Mike Douglas show or go on to the Johnny Carson show and talk about them and talk to 30 million Americans, you know. It was not an easy time, but when you're committed to a situation, you just stick with it because, you know, it's difficult to turn back.
In 1967, Hugh paired up with friend and producer Stuart Levine. They started their own production company and had a number one hit in 1968 with Up, Up and Away. His next record, probably his best known, Grazing in the Grass, sold over 4 million copies. But the politics of Hugh's music did not endear him to the record companies.
Because at that time we were very militant and went into the anti-Vietnam War. We were really anti-establishmentarian and really ravers. And of course our friends were people like Peter Fonda and Big Brother and the Holding Company, Jefferson Starship, The Doors, and all the anti-Vietnam War people, and we did a lot of concerts for the Black Power situation, for the civil rights. So I was so embroiled in that and the South African issue that I just couldn't relate to the gilded success at that time, you know. And I did an album after Grazing in the Grass just called Masekela, and it talked about gold and it talked about mason grenades and a lot of situations in South Africa, and I think that had over 80,000 returns. Everybody heard it. They said, what is this communistic music? And if you just change the titles of the songs, you know, just change the titles. We don't mind if you leave the songs as they are, you know. And they said, listen, if you can make a few more other Grazing in the Grasses. I said, when South Africa is free, maybe I'll do them, you know. But right now, this is what I want to express. So that never really endeared me a great deal in my 20s and early 30s to the recording in the industry. It was like a troublemaker because basically during that time almost all African-American artists except for myself and Miriam and maybe Belafonte and Odetta, everybody was basically singing love songs. You know, they just couldn't get into somebody singing protest. But that, of course, and the Panthers and the Civil Rights Movement did a lot to affect the record business. So that by 1970, people like Marvin Gaye did what's going on. Everybody started getting into that kind of situation.
Hugh, one of the things that has always really struck me about you is you've had a long international career, But you've never left South Africa behind. You never did you?
Well, I didn't have to. You know, I'd been, again, you know, I'd been like with Miriam Makeba, who spent all her life just working for Africa and sacrificed a great career, you know, for that. Belafonte lived for civil rights, you know, and he just like said to me, man, once you forget where you come from, you're going to end up in a bad place. Louis Armstrong never finished a paragraph without talking about New Orleans. And it goes back to Paul Robeson, you know, and even Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Shaka Zulu, Magana, or Inza, or Nika. I think that I was overseas physically, but spiritually, I could never have left the cradle that I come from, you know. And indeed, like after 12 years in the States, I got restless and I lived in the Congo, I lived in Botswana, I lived in Ghana, I lived in Nigeria, I lived in Liberia, I lived in Guinea. I just had to go to Africa because I wasn't from there. And what I found was like the world's greatest cultural rough diamond is just sitting there with all the stuff and is the only thing that they can't take away from us. It was never about me. I always wanted to brag about the people that I came from. And I think it's like something that is very, very important for us to like recapture and glorify and show off, because it's the strongest thing we have. My philosophy is that there's nothing in the world that Africa needs, but Africa is everything that the world needs. You know, they've taken it and they're taking it, but the one thing they can't take away is our heritage, and it's the one thing that we have to like build, and that is my biggest obsession.
In 1973, Hugh met Nigerian Afrobeat king Fela Kuti and began a long exploration into the music of West Africa and other African countries. Those years further shaped his music, particularly in the use of percussion and cross rhythms with voice and instrument. He travelled regularly between the US and Africa, living in Guinea for a while, and in the 1980s just over the South African border in Botswana. All the time, he was getting closer to home.
Fela was a dear friend. He was like a brother to me. And it's funny because more than anything else, although music bound us together, the thing that bound us most was the thing I'm talking about, because Fela felt as strongly about Africa. He abhorred African corruption, you know, and military, dictatorial African governments. But the thing that pulled us mostly together was we laughed. When we were together, we laughed so much. The one thing that I learned mostly with Fela is to laugh at the absurdity of what is happening to Africa, you know. Even though I object to it and oppose it very much. I mean, all of Fela's songs were jokes. Jokes against the establishment. He really like took the mickey out of them, and they're sad songs, but he made them funny. And he said, Hugh, you know, if you don't laugh, you won't make it. He used to say that, man, if you don't laugh, you won't make it. You know, you gotta laugh at this shit because it's funny. And then we'd be laughing. Then he'd say, isn't it sad, man? This shit is sad. It's so sad. It's funny, you know. He made fun of everybody, even guys like Wole Soyinka at the time. I didn't like Fela because he just thought they were part of the establishment. Ah, you with your degrees and your high English, you think you are a white man, you know. But they all respected him. Fela had somebody like who took notes of in the band, you know, because his band was like really well rehearsed. And he introduced me to West Africa. He introduced me to the reality of Africa. And playing with his band, I was there for a month and I played every day with him at the Shrine. You know, and his shows were like 12, 13 hours. And it was some of the most wonderful times, musical times in my life, because the band was just like, you know, that's the band that had like Dunde on trumpet and Tony Allen on drums and Kofi on percussion. It was just the most fantastic band.
If you call a woman African woman, no go green. She go say, she go say. Woman African woman no go green. She go say, she go say.
A friend of mine showed up in 79 by the name of Bloy Muloy, who had been a promoter when we were still in South Africa as teenagers, myself and Miriam. And he said, "We miss you guys, man. Why don't you come and play somewhere near home so that people can see you, since you can't come home?" So like, we eventually chose Lesotho, and in Christmas of 1980, we played at Maseru Stadium in Lesotho, myself and Miriam, for about 75,000 people who came from mostly South Africa. It was fabulous. And I was supposed to stay a week. I stayed 3 months. And a childhood friend of mine invited me to Botswana, where I met Kalahari. And it was like the first time, really, in 20 years that I was able to sing so freely in all my languages. The band knew all my songs. And I was talking Tswana, or Zulu, or Xhosa, or Sotho every day. It was something that I think my mouth and my body had missed.
There's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi. There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique. From Lesotho, from Botswana, from Swaziland, from all the hinterlands of southern and central Africa. This train carries young and old African men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropoli. 16 hours or more a day for almost no pay. Deep, deep, deep down in the belly of the earth, when they are digging and drilling for that shiny, mighty, evasive stone, or when they dish that mishmash mash food into their iron plates with the iron shovel, or when they sit in their stinky, funky, filthy, flea-ridden barracks and hostels, and they think about the loved ones they may never see again, because they might already have been forcibly removed from where they last left them, or wantonly murdered in the dead of night by roving and marauding gangs of no particular origin. We are told. They think about their lands and their herds that were taken away from them with the gun and the bomb and the tear gas and the Gatling and the cannon. And when they hear that choo-choo train, a chugging and a pumping and a smoking and a pushing and a pumping, a crying and a steaming and a chicken and a wah, wah. They always curse and they curse the coal train. The coal train that brought them to Johannesburg.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
I didn't have any hope at all that we'd ever come back. And in 1989, when some of my friends were calling me or writing to me and saying, "I think you should prepare to come back," I thought they were joking. And I didn't believe it until we saw Mandela. And we didn't think that they'd ever release Mandela and Tambo would be allowed to come back to South Africa. And when that happened, we knew we wouldn't be able to go back. And it was like an unexpected bonanza.
for people like me who, to be able to re-immerse myself in the life of South Africans, especially struggling South Africans, and like relearn the language and have an opportunity to absorb the things that I had taken for granted before and didn't learn. Crazy about Africa, as you can tell, but I'm very actively involved in letting Africans see Africa, because one of the things Africans are prevented from internationally is identifying themselves as a common group, and they've never seen each other in their excellence. They know only of each other from their misery side, and the world also portrays only the miserable side, the side we didn't cause. For Africa to come back to itself, it needs to see itself, to experience itself, to show off its excellence. And that way, the world will decide that maybe we should respect these people, because look at how grand they are and how fascinating they are. My biggest obsession, being back home, is to bring back musically and culturally, make visible those things about our culture that apartheid got rid of. And especially to South Africans and Africans, the visibility of their heritage is the most important thing, because I'm afraid that if I can't do that, my little granddaughter, Nairobi, who's 5 years old, when they ask her, "Who are you?" 20 years from now, I don't want her to say, "They say we used to be African."
Of Home and Heart, the musical journey of Hugh Masekela by Sharon Davis, engineered by Stephen Tilley. This story first aired on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. To hear more of Masekela's music, visit our website, thirdcoastfestival.org.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Resound. I'm Gwen Maxey. We'd love to hear about your journeys, musical and otherwise. Write to us at resound@thirdcoastfestival.org. While Hugh Masekela was fighting apartheid in South Africa, jazz singer Anne Searcy was fighting her own battle against discrimination on the East Coast of the United States. In our next story,
Anne, now much older and struggling with multiple sclerosis, reflects on her upbringing and how she came to meet her hero, the Duke.
Hello, folks.
Anne Searcy is a 76-year-old jazz singer. She spent most of her childhood as one of the only people of color in Old Orchard Beach, Maine. Her mother opened a guest home there for chauffeurs and maids who had probably never before had a chance to have a vacation.
Colored people didn't do too well in that town. One girl, a French girl, she used to say, "Hey, negra, I didn't like you. You're a nigger, a negra." I used to beat her up every single day. So she was running up the stairs. I grabbed her by her foot, and I was going to push her head on the metal strippings of the stairs. One of my teachers saw me, what I was going to do. She grabbed me. She said, "You could have killed her." I said, "Yeah, I guess I could have. I'm tired of being called nigger every single day." So my teacher said, "Ann, I am going to tell your mother." So I said, "All right, well, you can call my mother." But she told me if I didn't beat the children that called me nigger, she was going to beat me.
By the time Anne's mother opened her guest home in the early 30s, Old Orchard Beach was home to a carnival featuring amusement rides, hot dogs, and games of chance. The town's most recognizable feature was a 700-foot-long pier perched over the Atlantic surf. Big bands filled the pier's ballroom all summer long. One time, Edward Kennedy Ellington, known as the Duke, Duke Ellington, came to Anne's home and asked if he could rent a room.
I was introduced to him as Anne, and he, Mr. Ellington. And all through the years, he remained Mr. Ellington. We have had a piano in one of the rooms. He used to go in there and practice, and that's where I really got my love for music.
Mr. Ellington and his baritone sax player, Harry Carney, took a special interest in Anne. They must have known what her life was like in that small town. They called Anne from the road and gave her free tickets to all the shows in New England. By the time she was 18, Anne was already developing a singing career of her own, playing in lounges in small coastal towns.
I get sort of a happy feeling when I do sing. All my feelings come out in the words to those songs.
The summer after Anne graduated from high school, Mr. Ellington played a concert with his band at the pier in Old Orchard. Anne put on her best dress and some high-heeled shoes for the show. She walked to the pier and collected her free tickets. She walked into the hall, out over the ocean. The Duke had a surprise in store for Anne that night.
Well, he asked me. He called me Anne. "Miss Anne, come here." I guess my mouth must have just flown open. He said, "Anne, as many times as we have played when you have been right along with us, you have never, ever requested a song." So I said, "How about Tenderly?" So he said, "Miss Anne, even as old as I am, I still can play Tenderly." So I did get a chance to sing that song with the band. "The evening breeze caress the trees tenderly. The trembling trees embrace the breeze tenderly your arms open wide and closed me inside. You took my lips, you took my love so tenderly. That's the only part I can remember.
Today, Anne lives in a Portland nursing home. She has multiple sclerosis and needs some help getting around. Two autographed photos of Duke and Mildred Ellington hang on the wall in her bedroom. She looks at them every morning. And some days, she sits in her wheelchair in the rec room and sings to her friends and neighbors.
Anne Meets Mr. Ellington was produced by Carrie Seed at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland, Maine. ReSound is a production of the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program is produced by Katie Mingle and curated by Johanna Zorn and Julie Shapiro of the Third Coast Festival. The Third Coast Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Boeing Company Charitable Trust, the Agudino Foundation, Chicago's Navy Pier, and American Airlines. This program is partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. Special thanks to our many individual contributors from Chicago and around the world. If you want to contact us, we would love to hear from you. Email us at resound@thirdcoastfestival.org. ReSound returns next week with more radio that you can't hear anywhere else unless you live everywhere else.
You've been listening to the Third Coast Podcast. Now that it's over, here are a few suggestions. Become our fan on Facebook. Write us a review on iTunes. Buy a t-shirt in our merch shop or make a donation to support what we do at thirdcoastfestival.org. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.